On behalf of the Commonwealth Club of California and the World Affairs Council of Northern California, I'm very pleased to welcome all of you this evening for our event with His Excellency Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, President of the Republic of Iceland. I'm Carla Thorsen. I'm the Vice President for Programs here at the World Affairs Council and the chair of today's program. Tonight's event will be moderated by Mr. Greg Dalton, who is Vice President of the Commonwealth Club and also Director of the Club's Climate One project. Now, please allow me to just give a brief description of today's sponsoring organizations. The Commonwealth Club of California is the nation's oldest and largest public affairs forum, bringing together its more than 20,000 members for over 400 annual events on topics ranging across politics, culture, society, and the economy. You can find more information about the clubs on its website, commonwealthclub.org. And the World Affairs Council of Northern California offers a neutral forum on critical international issues and opportunities. To learn more about the council and hear its programs or join its membership, please visit our website, worldaffairs.org. Now, as a courtesy to our speaker this evening, may we ask that everyone please take a moment to turn off all your cell phones, any other noise-making devices that you might have. And also, please note that there are question cards on your seats, and we do encourage you to take a moment to write a question for the president if you wish to ask one. Staff will collect them. Oh, I need to turn my phone off. Excuse me. Staff will collect them throughout the program and share them with the moderator. I'd like to thank all of you for coming tonight, and let me also recognize a few of our special guests here with us this evening. The First Lady of Iceland is joining her husband along with his special advisor to the president, the Honorary Consul of Iceland, and the Consuls General of Switzerland and Norway are all with us this evening, so welcome to all of you. Now it's my great pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished guest. His Excellency Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson has been Iceland's president since 1996, and he is currently serving his fifth elected term in office. He has served a long and an illustrious career in public service, first as a professor of political science at the University of Iceland, and later holding numerous positions within the Icelandic government. Iceland, as we all know, is on the edge of the Arctic Circle and is one of the key players in the Arctic Council. And President Grímsson has taken a very active role on issues of climate and climate change that are affecting the Arctic more so now than other places around the globe. And we're delighted to have him with us today on Earth Day to speak to us about people and ice, the new significance of the Arctic and the Himalayas. So please join me in welcoming His Excellency Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson.
Thank you very much. Now you are much taller than I am.
Well, thank you very much for this introduction and your excellencies, ladies and gentlemen, dear friends. It's indeed an honor for me to address you on this very important and symbolic day when people on different continents come together to reflect on the fate of our shared planet, but also to examine how challenging it has indeed been to bring the threat of irreversible climate change to the forefront of global concerns. We all know there have been multitudes of forums and conferences. There have been dialogues and discussions in abundance. The world's diplomats and negotiators have met at what we could call almost a jamborees of diplomatic negotiations and made proposals and speeches from Kyoto to Bali to Copenhagen to Cancun to Durban and other places. Presidents in this great country have taken office. and departed Clinton, Bush, Obama, now well into his second term. Al Gore was awarded an Oscar and the Nobel Peace Prize. And yet, we are still far from taking the necessary action. Even the most recent IPCC report has not received the urgent attention it so definitely deserves. And as the Greenland glaciers and the Arctic sea ice continue to melt faster than ever, and NASA, this great scientific institution of this country, issues extreme warnings, some of us have asked, a bit bewildered, why does the political and corporate leadership of most countries honor and respect your space agency because it landed a man on the moon and recently a robot on Mars, but almost ignore it altogether when it gives us alarming news about our own Mother Earth? The answer is, of course, complicated. But this question highlights the fact that the core problem regarding climate change is one of perception, the absence of a comprehensive and compelling vision. And while we see the moon and Mars as a whole, we have always had a very fragmented view of our own planet. This is especially so with respect to glaciers and the ice-covered regions. In Iceland, we have traditionally been preoccupied with our own glaciers, which are admittedly the largest in Europe. And although the Arctic is now, as I will discuss later, coming higher on the global agenda, the significance of the Greenland ice sheet is not generally understood. It is, in fact, a glacial ice mass close to Canada and the United States, but half the size of Western Europe. You have to add together Germany, France, Italy, and a few other European countries to get to the size of the Greenland ice sheet. And most maps hanging in classrooms show Antarctica as a narrow line at the bottom, while North America dominates the upper middle on the left and the European continent on the right. And because of these maps, generations have been unaware that the Antarctic ice covers, in fact, a greater area than the United States. You have to throw in Mexico in addition to get close to the size of the Antarctic ice sheet. The Himalayas, with their thousands of glaciers, harbor water reservoirs for the great rivers of China, India, and many other Asian countries. And although this hospitable harmony might in fact soon be threatened, the world has not yet comprehended that horrific prospect. Though, remarkably, Chinese scientists are now using the striking expression the third pole, referring to the Himalayas, in order to make that region, together with the Arctic and Antarctica, central to our concern. So perhaps we might follow that Chinese example and start talking about the first pole, the second pole, and the third pole, instead of these geographically isolated areas on the global map. Because all of us have culturally, historically, and politically in all nations been brought up with a view of Mother Earth in which the eyes is peripheral. We have not yet acknowledged economically, politically, or culturally that we do in fact, all of us live in an ice-dependent world. Our weather, our climate, our crops, and definitely our cities, wherever they are dependent in one way or another on what happens to the ice. The glaciers are therefore not divorced from our fate. They are, in fact, what we could say, the core of our common future. The Arctic, the Himalayas, and Antarctica are not isolated and separate parts of our global homeland. Their fate and our fate, their future and our future are closely connected. And unless we bring them together and to the center of our joint scientific and political concerns, I fear that the discussions and the dialogues on climate change will probably continue to be of little consequence. But when we succeed in linking Antarctica, and especially the Himalayas and the Arctic together, making them central to our vision, we could perhaps achieve what I have sometimes lightheartedly called our global aha moment, combining in this way the first letters, but especially referring to what we are all familiar with, that we have experienced a number of such aha moments in our lives, when suddenly we understand something, we comprehend a truth we were unaware of before. We recognize the meaning of what the other fellow is saying and respond by saying, aha, yes, now I understand. What is the essence of what you are saying? And although it's a light-hearted way of putting a very serious problem, I fundamentally believe that climate change needs such aha moments in order to transform the global dialogue and especially our actions. And linking our concerns and our efforts, especially to the Arctic and the Himalayas. So we together, the people of Mother Earth, have the opportunity to pave the way for the necessary action. And in this respect, the Arctic and the Himalayas are particularly relevant because unlike Antarctica, they are, and have been for thousands of years, the home of indigenous people. And both have recently gained a new global importance due to the emerging involvement of leading economic powers in both the future of the Arctic and the Himalayas. It is, in fact, worth thinking about, and it is somewhat remarkable how recently, in historic terms, the educated Western world, the public in Europe and here in the United States and elsewhere, became familiar with this remote, vast, unknown Arctic regions. My father, just to indicate how recent this has all come to our attention, my father was still a young shepherd chasing sheep in the Icelandic valleys, when the famous Norwegian discoverers, Ronald Amundsen and Fridtjof Nansen, made their pioneering Arctic journeys. And together with their Icelandic-Canadian colleague, Vilhjálmur Stefánsson, these three discoverers embodied in the early decades of the 20th century a spirit of Arctic discovery which was new, but also widely admired. And so fresh in living memory were their discoveries that they were celebrated both in Norway and Iceland when our two countries enjoyed recent independence. And then Throughout the second half of the 20th century, the Arctic still remained largely unknown, except, of course, for the indigenous people who have lived there for millennia. But they didn't really have much of a voice in the global discussion. And the Arctic was primarily unknown throughout the second half of the 20th century because of the escalating military buildup that took place there, both from the Soviet side and from the NATO side, from Alaska to Murmansk, with numerous military bases all over the Arctic, with missiles, with submarines, with aircraft. In fact, every type of military technology invented during the second half of the 20th century was placed in one way or another somewhere in the Arctic. It became, in fact, the heart of the Cold War confrontation, almost a no-go zone during this entire second half of the last century. So we can truly say that in historic terms, compared to the thousands of years of European and Asian civilization, the Arctic, as a territory of human cooperation, as this new playing field of economic and political interest, is practically like a new planet. A region so young in the global context that we cannot really find any parallel to understand that completely. And when the Arctic Council was established in the 1990s, the first attempt for systematic cooperation in the Arctic during the Clinton-Gore administration, the United States, Russia, Canada, and the five Nordic countries, including Iceland, were still very hesitant in their endeavors on what this new organization should in fact do. And the mandate was very limited, mostly restricted to science and the environment. But in recent years, the Arctic Council has matured remarkably and been transformed into a successful instrument of treaty negotiations and wide-ranging agreements and practical endeavors. And even more remarkably, last year, at the meeting of the foreign ministers of the Arctic Councils, attended, among others, by John Kerry, the Secretary of State, it was decided that from now on, more than half of the G20 countries, including leading states in Asia and Europe, will in one way or another join the United States, Russia, Canada, and the rest of us from the Nordic countries at the Arctic table. Countries like China, India, Japan, South Korea, France, Germany, United Kingdom, Italy, even Singapore has now got a formal seat at the Arctic table. And other countries in both Latin America and the Middle East are considering to apply. There are, of course, many reasons why in a remarkably short time the Arctic has been turned into this global playing field. It is probably the largest reservoir of untouched natural resources anywhere in the world. Minerals, rare metals, not only oil and gas, but also the largest reservoir of hydropower and probably wind power to be found anywhere on the globe. But especially the melting of the Arctic sea ice is already opening up new sea routes, the so-called northern sea routes, linking China and other Asian countries to the US and Europe in a way nobody thought possible a few decades ago, shortening the sailing time by about 10 days, saving enormous amount of fuel and costs, being in fact a global transformation similar to what the Suez Canal did in its time with respect to global shipping and trade. So suddenly the Arctic, which in the early years of my father's life was still unknown to the European and the American population, has now become the new global playing field where prominent economic and political forces of our times, both in Asia, Europe, and in America, are moving gradually towards securing their long-term presence and their long-term interest. But don't let us forget, especially not on this day, that the melting of the Arctic sea ice is also of great consequences for the climate, for extreme weather patterns in faraway parts of the world, including China and the United States. This was demonstrated very clearly nearly 2 years ago when the Polar Research Institute of China sent the icebreaker Snow Dragon from Shanghai along the northern sea route along the Russian coast to Iceland. The first time in human history a vessel from China has arrived in an Arctic state. And then going back to Shanghai, close to the North Pole. Aboard the Snow Dragon were over 60 young Chinese scientists who had, along the way, carried out extraordinary research on the transformation taking place in the Arctic. But they studied especially the relationship between the melting of the Arctic sea ice and weather patterns in middle and lower latitudes in China, because their data had demonstrated that there was a strong correlation between the freezing rain in southern China during the winter of 2007 to 2008 and the Arctic sea ice minimum of 2007. But then again, in February and January of last year, China suffered its worst winter in decades, a disaster which was not covered very much in the Western media, neither in television nor in newspapers. And these disasters were directly caused by the melting of the Arctic sea ice in 2012. The destruction was enormous for infrastructure, electricity lines, and also food production. Just to give you a visual example, almost 200,000 cattle froze to death out in the field because of the sudden weather changes. Thus, what happens in my Arctic neighborhood causes not decades in the future, but within a few months, extreme weather patterns and profound destruction to the daily lives in the people of China. And these dramatic events, although they were not covered very much by the Western media, neither in my country nor here in the United States, they are consistent with the findings of, for example, the US scientist Jennifer Francis of the Rutgers University in New Jersey and many others, experts on atmospheric science, who have showed that there is a correlation between the increased heat in the Arctic and jet streams, which in turn cause extreme weather events in lower latitudes. And therefore, the destruction, which you are familiar with, of Hurricane Sandy in New York and New Jersey and other eastern U.S. regions is a part of this same pattern, directly related to what is happening in my Arctic neighborhood. So if it was only for these reasons, there is a need to link the Arctic, but also, as I will explain, the Himalayas, together in a new vision of how the melting of the ice affects people everywhere, on every continent, in every country. And that is why I have in recent years, with many others, tried and worked hard to initiate wide-ranging cooperation to that effect. Last October in Reykjavik, at the first assembly of what was called and is called the Arctic Circle, a new venue for international dialogue and cooperation on ice-related issues, attended by over 1,200 participants from 40 nations, demonstrating the fast-growing global interest in the Arctic, we not only discussed the recent scientific discoveries or resource utilization, or business cooperation, and the opening of the new sea routes, but also how the nations in the Himalaya region can learn from the success of the Arctic cooperation. This new Arctic Himalayan dimensions throws a light on the interaction between glaciers and water and soil, between glaciers and food productions and vegetation, in all its aspects, on the relationship between people and ice, on the fate of communities on every continent, however far they are from the ice-covered regions. And we are going to continue this Arctic-Himalayan dialogue in the fall of this year at a forum we are planning in Bhutan, which will be attended by scientists and policymakers, not only from the Himalayan countries, but also from other parts of the world. And Bhutan is well placed for that dialogue because that small country in the Himalayas is severely threatened by the melting of the Himalayan glaciers. But we will also continue this Arctic-Himalayan dialogue at the second assembly of the Arctic Circle, which will take place in Reykjavik towards the end of October this year. The linking, which is new, of the Arctic and the Himalayas in this way started in the summer of 2011, when I was privileged, together with the University of Iceland, to host a meeting of what is called the Third Pole Environmental Workshop, attended by numerous scientists, not only from countries in the Himalayan regions, but also from the United States and Europe, led, among others, by Lonnie Thompson of Ohio State University. After discussing for a few days the retreat of the Himalayan glaciers and the consequences for the water systems, the soils, and the vegetations, these Himalayan scientists made a field trip to the largest Icelandic glacier, Vatnajökull, because it turns out that you can learn a lot about the Himalayan glaciers by studying our glaciers in Iceland, with the advantage also that you don't have to go as high as you have to do in the Himalayan region. And then the participants in the Third Pole Workshop joined the Open Assembly of the Northern Research Forum, which is an association of scholars and scientists and policymakers from the 8 Arctic countries. It was, in fact, a few years ago, the first time in history that the scientific and the research communities of the Himalayas and the Arctic joined hands in this way. And this is among the signs that the leaders of many Asian countries are becoming increasingly aware, perhaps more so than leaders in the Western world, of how the melting of the ice will affect their people, causing profound changes in the ecology of their region, affecting atmospheric circulation, but also agriculture and energy systems. Glacial melting contributes up to 45% of the total river flow in the tributaries of the Indus, the Ganges, and the Brahmaputra. Water from these three rivers is crucial for the food security of about 500 million people. They are the lifelines of some of Asia's most densely populated areas, from the arid plains of Pakistan to the thirsty metropolis of northern China, 3,000 miles away. Around 2 billion people in more than a dozen countries, nearly a third of the world's population, depend in one way or another on the rivers fed at least partly by the snow and the ice of the Himalayan region. These prospects help to explain why China in recent years, and also India, are now putting funds and enhanced scientific resources into monitoring their ice-dependent world, and also why the smaller countries like Nepal and Bhutan are so profoundly concerned. The most eminent glaciologist in Asia, Yao Tatong, has warned that in 20 years' time, another 30% of the Himalayan glaciers will have disappeared. And by the middle of this century, perhaps 40%. And then he predicts that by the beginning of the next century, the 22nd century, which is not that far away for those young people that can hope to be 90, that by the beginning of the 22nd century, 70% of the Himalayan glaciers will in all likelihood have disappeared. And don't let's forget, these are among the most militarily sensitive regions in the world, where the leading economies of the 21st century are situated. And a shrinkage of the Himalayan glaciers of that scale will eventually lead to monumental economic, political, and even military catastrophes in addition to the ecological and the environmental disasters in food production and water systems. So therefore, my dear friends, as we meet here today, we must and can soberly reflect on these dramatic connections which we have as a human race, even as the educated Western world, so recently discovered between people and ice, between glaciers and the fate of our nations wherever they are on the planet. And then I have not even talked about the threat of rising sea levels and the effect that will have on cities everywhere in the world, because it's so evident that if only a quarter of the Greenland ice sheet melts, and nothing will melt in Antarctica, the sea level rise globally will be about 2 meters. Only with a quarter of the Greenland ice sheet melting and everything else remaining as it has been for centuries. But let me, in conclusion, more optimistically, also invite you, the members of the council here and other institutions in San Francisco and elsewhere in the United States, to join the rest of us to engage in these newly established and so far highly successful avenues for dialogue and cooperation on both the Arctic and the Himalayas. And you can do that individually or through your organizations, being part of this growing global dialogue and cooperation, either by attending the Arctic Circle Assembly in Reykjavik next October, or even both by linking your efforts to the Himalayan Third Pole Circle, which has already been accepted by leading countries in the Himalaya regions as an effective venue for global dialogue and discussions on what lies ahead. And in this way, you can join others in a productive and cooperative way in moving the world forward to comprehend the fundamental linkage between people and ice. That is the core of my message to you here today. I thank you again for inviting me, and I'm willing to answer any questions that you would like to put. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to His Excellency Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, President of Iceland. I'm Greg Dalton, host of Climate One at the Commonwealth Club, and we'll moderate our question and answer period. I have a lot of questions here, Mr. President. The first one is, you mentioned an aha moment. What was your personal aha moment when you realized that climate change would be an issue in your lifetime?
I think my aha moment was about 25, 30 years ago, when I was traveling in the interior of Iceland, And the glaciologist who was ahead of our expedition pointed out new mountains and new valleys that had come in the recent years from under the glaciers. Mountains and valleys that no human eye had seen until very recently. And then in the 1980s, I was privileged to cooperate with a number of people from different parts of the world, including then Senator Al Gore and others, scientists especially. But it was in the first years of my presidency that I realized that what was happening in the Arctic, in my own neighborhood, was really a global wake-up call, not just of importance for us, but of great importance to people everywhere. And since then, I have gradually worked for cooperation in this field. But it was an uphill battle, because until very recently, for most people, the Arctic was very peripheral, not really worth talking about. Himalayas, yes, far away. Maybe climbing Everest, yes, it might make the news. But that was the end of it. For people in France, Germany, New York, to realize that what was happening to the ice was of importance to them was such a strange idea that no president that took himself seriously even tried to talk about it in meetings. But the big shift which has taken place now in the last 1 or 2 years is that now people everywhere are willing to listen.
Let's talk about solutions. We have a couple of questions about what like your country is doing on renewables and what Iceland can offer the international community to ameliorate these things you've outlined.
Well, I think Iceland is an interesting place in the sense that we don't really need to go to international conferences to become convinced of climate change. We just see it happening. We see it happening. So you can come to Iceland, and in a matter of a few days, you can realize what's happening. But you can also, in that same trip, witness the solution. Because when I was growing up, even into my teenage years, the part of Iceland where I came from was entirely driven by imported oil and coal. Fossil fuel was the only source of energy. 80% of Iceland's energy in my early years came from imported fossil fuel. During the lifetime of my generation, we have moved the country from being in that way dependent on imported oil and coal and becoming the number one in the world in terms of clean energy. So now 100% of our electricity comes from clean energy resources. 100% of the heating of our houses comes from clean energy resources. And it's not subsidized. It is profoundly good business. You might have heard of the banking crisis in Iceland. One of the reasons why we recovered so effectively and so early was the clean energy transformation that made us strong in the energy sector and the industrial sector. Now we are trying to import electric cars to Iceland. So if we succeed in that, I think Iceland has a reasonable chance within 10 or 15 years to become the first country in the world where all land-based activity comes from renewable energy. And I don't accept the argument that you can do this simply because it's Iceland, where we are situated, or that we are small. When Xi Jinping was the president of China, some of you might remember, he was not the last president, but the previous one. He came on a state visit to Iceland. It shows how long I've been in this office. So I took him to my geothermal power plant. And he brought about a quarter of the Chinese government with him. And they were all engineers. And they had never been to a geothermal power plant. And they became absolutely fascinated. So to cut a long story short, now we are cooperating with Sinopec in closing down coal power stations in Chinese cities and replacing them with geothermal urban heating systems. And the net benefit is not simply a transformation of energy, but better health, reducing diseases, healthier lifestyles, and also a population which is happier. Because every year in China for the last 8 or 9 years, there have been almost 100,000 demonstrations a year because of environmental issues. We often tend to think of China as a country without demonstrations. It's not true. There are probably as many demonstrations in China as there are in the US. But they are mostly on environmentally related issues. And the US, my friends, could do the same. It's the best kept energy secret in this country that if you utilized your geothermal resources in the same way as we have done in Iceland on the basis of existing technologies, you could derive twice the present consumption of electricity in the United States. And this was demonstrated by the MIT report published and headed by one of the great professors about 5 or 6 years ago. And as I said, it's the best kept secret in the energy debate in the US.
A fair amount of power actually in Northern California does come from geothermal. Another question from the audience about economic opportunity is about the commercial and economic interests that Iceland envisions with the new sea routes. Will that help commerce?
Well, whether it helps commerce or not, it is simply a reality. At the first assembly of the Arctic Circle in Reykjavik, which is the kind of a Davos of the Arctic last October, the head of COSCO, the big Chinese shipping company, the biggest shipping company in the world, came and made a remarkable speech where he described the journey of their container ship, which recently had sailed from China all the way to Rotterdam. And he presented a figure of the saving in energy costs and fuel, as well as shortening the distance, and explained that now it was one of the pillars of COSCO's strategy for the next 20 years to build more ships that will do this. South Korea is now an observer state in the Arctic Council. Why on earth should South Korea want to be an observer state in the Arctic Council? It's a simple explanation. South Korea is one of the major shipping and shipbuilding countries in the world. One of the biggest harbors in Germany, in Bremen, it's the second largest harbor in Germany, has now entered into agreements with engineering companies and other institutes in Iceland to examine the possibilities of building in the northeastern part of Iceland what they call a global Arctic harbor. So we already have business companies in Asia, in Europe, investing money, effort, expertise in preparing themselves for this transformation. And it is open seas, whatever we say, because the international law is that a commercial vessel can sail these routes. They can't fish inside the 200 miles, but they can send container vessels. So if the ice melts, as the head of COSCO said, for at least 3 months a year or so, make the calculation if only a quarter of the cargo traffic between China and other Asian countries to Europe and the United States would go the north route. But then he argued more than a quarter will do it, because in that opening of 3 months, although it's a quarter of the year, because it is not as expensive, it saves in terms of days and fuel costs and so on, there will be more than a quarter of the global traffic that will go that way. Will Iceland benefit? That remains to be seen. It will not be, I think, a decision taken by us, because it will be big global corporate interest that will decide where the main service station or the main harbors will be built. But then go home and look at the map and realize that another part of this northern sea route could come along the US sort of Canadian way. Where is the US global Arctic harbor going to be? Where in Alaska? That is a decision that has not been taken. But the governor of Maine is coming to Iceland next month, because Maine has suddenly discovered that Maine, in terms of shipping, is the eastern Arctic outpost of the United States. I'm sure most of you have never thought of Maine as an Arctic territory. But the governor has now woken up to these possibilities because he sees the traffic in northern Canada, in Greenland, coming along this route and so on. So it is an extraordinarily fast transformation. Where the harbors will exactly be, and nobody can predict at the moment. But as I've told you with these concrete examples, there are established major corporate concerns from both Europe and Asia that are already placing themselves. And let me conclude by mentioning Singapore. You all know why is Singapore affluent. Of course, they had good policies, but also they are a hub. They are a hub to the global transport system in the 20th century, helped by the Suez Canal. A few years ago, Singapore established a special Arctic ambassador to Singapore, in Singapore. And when the Prime Minister of Singapore last year had a meeting with President Obama, the Arctic was number one on his agenda. Number one. It surprised the White House. Number one on his agenda. Because Singapore realizes that if a quarter or more of the global cargo traffic starts going the northern sea route, there will be less traffic going through the hubs in Singapore. And through international cooperation with some Arctic countries, whether it's Iceland or some others, Singapore is willing to be a part of the evolution in the Arctic. That's why Singapore is now an observer state in the Arctic Council.
Our guest today is Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson, president of Iceland. Another question from the audience. Do you think most, if not all, disputes in the Arctic can be settled by diplomacy?
Well,
you might also talk about particularly Russia. People worry about Russia a lot, especially these days.
Yeah, it is perhaps a bit paradoxical, given the recent events and the recent discussion about the Russia-European and U.S. relations, that contrary to what was predicted almost 20 years ago, that it would be very difficult to move from the Cold War confrontation in the Arctic, which I described briefly in my speech, to constructive cooperation, especially with Russia. The fact of the matter is, 15, 20 years later, that the Arctic cooperation is perhaps the most outstanding positive example of what can be done. Led by Russia, the US, Canada, and the five Nordic countries. And the Russian ambassador to the Arctic Council has played a very constructive role in negotiating the search and rescue agreement, in negotiating the recent oil spills agreement. Russia has made various agreements with Norway on Arctic disputes that were unsolved for decades. So whatever Russia is doing in other parts of the world, if we look at the facts of the Arctic cooperation, one of the reasons why we have been able to do so much in such a short time is the constructive cooperation between the United States, Russia, Canada, and us in the Nordic countries at the Arctic table. The U.S. will take on the chairmanship of the Arctic Council next year. It will be the first time, because it's a rotating chairmanship, after the Arctic Council became a prominent negotiating body, that the U.S. takes on the chairmanship. And it will be very interesting to see how the administration in Washington uses that opportunity to move this cooperation forward.
There's a question about the Arctic Council and reaction to Canada's recently leaving its greenhouse gas commitments under Kyoto. Has that been an issue in the Arctic Council?
Well, it depends how you look at it. Even during the Cold War period, there were scientists in America, in Canada, in Russia and the Nordic countries who were cooperating on the ice. And in fact, the first major achievement of the Arctic Council more than 10 years ago were two reports, one called the Arctic Climate Assessment Report, and the other was the Arctic Human Development Report. And these two reports demonstrated long before the IPCC came forward with their predictions that the Arctic ice was melting three times faster. Climate change was happening three times faster in the Arctic than anywhere else in the world. So this scientific dimension, looking at what's happening to the ice, is one of the core elements in the Arctic cooperation, all not just through the scientific communities, but also through the role of the indigenous people, because the Arctic Council is remarkable among international organizations in the way that indigenous organizations, whether they are in Alaska, Canada, Russia, or in the Nordic countries, the Inuit people, they have a voice, they have a formal voice, they have a formal representation. And they are all speaking the same message. They are all telling people what's happening to the villages, to the communities, to the traditional ways of life. So you cannot really attend any Arctic conference or attend any Arctic dialogue for a day or so without becoming acutely aware of what climate change is doing to the Arctic territories.
Another question about population and Iceland's low growth population growth rate and what you are doing about it. Can you improve this? And you
might also low population growth. You mean compared to the U.S.?
1%. Yeah. So is population?
Oh, no. I think we have more. The last time I counted was, I think we had over 2% or something. So, in fact. Maybe it's an illusion, but we in Iceland think we are pretty good compared to other European countries in terms of population growth. And we definitely have one of the youngest population of any European countries. So the same problem as Germany and France and other face in terms of aging population, we don't have it in Iceland. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is the independent role of women in Iceland, we respect that to bring up a child is the responsibility also of the community and the entire family. We have for a long time had a very extensive law on both first mother's right for maternity leave, and in recent years we obliged every father also to take a leave from his job to be a part of bringing up the children. Even if there is a divorce or there are single mothers that bring up the children, there is no legal or social discrimination against such a situation. So I'm a bit surprised with this question. I thought we were doing pretty well compared to the U.S. and the other European countries, but maybe I should go back home and read more about my statistics.
But your answer seems to be that more growth is better, and is that... If that's the case, what does that mean for population as a driver and the climate context?
Well, the population of Iceland, as you know, is small, over 300,000 people in a country the size of England. If you take Scotland and Wales away, I'm not saying you should vote yes in the referendum, but but if you take them away, you end up with a country similar to what Iceland is. And it's worth doing that because then you get a better sense of what is required. So there's a lot of space in Iceland for more people. And we have had a considerable immigration. It might surprise people that among European countries, Iceland is in the top quarter of percentage of people who are born outside of Iceland. For a number of years, the name prevented people from coming. I mean, when you were thinking of a country where you should settle... But now global media has changed that. Now people know Iceland is an extraordinary place, highly advanced society despite the financial crisis and so on. So we don't have a deliberate policy of increasing the population, but we welcome what we have considered this high birth rate in our country, which you are hinting is an illusion, but I mean, we will see.
Whoever wrote that, where are you? We have a couple of questions about the economic meltdown that you referenced, and I know you've written about lessons learned from the meltdown in the late 2008 or so, yeah. And you've written that solving the climate crisis also has to get at some changes in capitalism, so you might tie those two together.
Well, I think the banking crisis in my country, like in the United States, but in my country especially, was a very profound, disturbing experience for the nation. And in many ways, I believe that although Iceland is small, it's like a laboratory. It's like a box where you can see the interaction between elements that you also find in a larger society. We are among the most open, stable, democratic countries in the world. And within a few months after the banks collapsed, we had riots, we had demonstrations, the police had to defend the central bank, the parliament, the ministerial offices, and so on. So one of the lessons from the Icelandic experience is that financial markets, banks, and financial institutions carry an extraordinary social and political and even democratic responsibility. This whole notion that was very popular and common, both in academic thinking and definitely in Western business ideology, that the market was an entity in itself, was sovereign in itself, and the only thing that mattered was the rate of return for the companies and the shareholders, that was completely shattered in the crisis in Iceland. Because if a financial collapse can do that to a country as stable and democratic as Iceland, with the oldest parliament in the world, imagine what it can do in countries that have very recent democratic institutions. And I often remind my European colleagues, because we have a tendency in Europe to think we've always been democratic. We are somehow the great model of democracy. You can even read that in the papers these very days, recent events. But during the first years of my life, there were only 6 democracies in Europe. And all except one were in Northern Europe. The only exception was Switzerland, but then it's debatable whether they were democratic because the women couldn't vote. But the rest of Europe, almost all of Europe, apart from Ireland and England and Sweden and Iceland, were under either fascist, communist, or Nazi dictatorship. And although we now know the outcome, it was not known when I was born. So we have, even in recent European history, evidence of how difficult it is to root democracy. So I'm telling you this because when we come to the climate change issue, this whole notion that the market only has to think about itself and every other thing is not the responsibility of the market. The quarterly return is the only thing that matters. This has been demonstrated by the financial crisis in Europe, the US, and especially in my country, as an ideological illusion. Whether people like it or not. And the experience in my country convinced everybody of this social, political, democratic responsibility. And the same with climate change. Why is Mayor Bloomberg so interested in climate change? Because he saw part of his city destroyed by extreme weather patterns. Because he had to go out not once, not twice, but many times during his years as mayor to warn people against the weather coming and asking them, please, please stay at home, don't go out in the streets. Why was this huge destruction in New Jersey and elsewhere? Why is China, as I described, sending scientists up to the Arctic? Because the leadership of China, and it was the president of China in discussion with me that announced that they were sending the snow dragon. They realized that the greatest disasters in China in the last 4 years, which have caused more economic destruction in China than Hurricane Sandy did here in the United States, was largely caused, mainly caused by what's happening to the ice in my part of the world. The reason why China is now aggressively taking the leadership, as it is, whether we like it or not, in wind power, solar power, geothermal power. The largest geothermal projects in the world are now taking place in China. The largest solar projects in the world are now taking place in China. The largest wind power projects are now taking place in China. It's not because they have somehow, in an altruistic way, discovered that climate change is a good cause. No, no. They have realized the destructive effect on cities, infrastructure, investment, economies, food production, electricity lines, in the same way as we discovered in Iceland the effect of banking collapse on our democratic and social and political harmony. So those who argue that climate change is not of concern to the business community, I say to them, talk to the insurance companies. Ask the insurance companies why they are no longer willing to insure houses in certain cities and certain streets close to the ocean. Talk to the leaders of all the biggest insurance companies in the world. You get the same message. That they face a choice, either stop insuring big part of coastal cities anywhere in the world, or aggressively try to change the causes that lead us to climate change. So like the shipping through the Northern Sea Route is driven by commercial interest, I believe the insurance companies should be the wake-up call for anybody who wants to look at the market in this way. If they don't believe me, they don't believe the scientists, they don't believe the indigenous people in the Arctic, they don't believe the people in the Himalayas, they don't believe the people in Bhutan, then talk to the CEO of some of the biggest insurance companies.
They certainly get it because they're seeing it and they're feeling it. That's a segue to our, perhaps our last audience question, which is it in the interest of some big money to deny climate change and block progress towards solutions?
Well, I have a great sympathy for people having difficulty in comprehending this issue. I mean, I don't take the position that this is a no-brainer, that this is something that you should easily accept and recognize. Because as I hinted in my speech, it is extraordinary that my father was already into his teenage years when the first humans went to Antarctica. The first humans to Antarctica. And this whole discovery of the Arctic regions was a part of the first one or two decades of the last century. That's why Nansen and Amundsen and Stefansson were such media heroes here in the United States. In San Francisco, they were applauded and lauded in this city in the early years and decades of the 20th century. So I think it's very easy to understand how difficult it is to get to grips with this issue. I sometimes say jokingly to my good friends, President Clinton and Al Gore, that even they, in the Clinton-Gore administration, didn't want the Arctic Council to do very much. Only a very limited mandate. Only a meeting every second year. No treaty, no formal agreements, nothing. So if some of the most enlightened people on climate change ever to have such a role in the US administration, 15 years ago were thinking in such limited terms, so, then how on earth should we expect people in the business world and others all of a sudden to come forward and realize this problem and then change what they're doing, especially since not only the coal companies, but the car companies and many others have made an extraordinary good way of life and good returns by doing things that they have been doing. And let's also face it, the great cities we enjoy, and this city is one of them, my city, Reykjavik, is another, were built on fossil fuel. If you went to Reykjavik in the 40s, you saw a big coal cloud covering the city. Reykjavik was a city built on coal. So I am patient in the sense that I realize that you can't expect people suddenly to change their ways because the awareness of this is so very recent. But the problem is we have such a short time. That's the problem. This is basically a race about the next 30 or 40 years. Because if we don't make this transformation in the next 30 or 40 years, it will probably be irreversible. And what does that mean? It means that not only a quarter of the Greenland ice it melts, as I said before, but Antarctica will start to melt, and the Himalayas. Listen to Yao Tantong, the leading Asian glaciologist. If you don't believe me, listen to him. And he is a person which the Chinese leadership has have made the leader of their glacial research in China. He is, by the way, trained in the United States, so he is an excellent example of the scientific sort of cooperation. So I think we should respectfully, and I emphasize that, respectfully try to change the corporate mind and the corporate community on this. We should not be hostile or critical or disgusted by the ways that they are operating. And try to bring people forward in understanding that whether we like it or not, as I said in my speech, we are all dependent on ice. And once we understand that, we have made the shift. We have made the ideological, the intellectual, the policy shift, which is necessary. And that is why I am very happy to be invited to speak with you here tonight, why I'm happy to be speaking about this issue in Los Angeles in a few days' time, in New York before the end of this month, because this is new in America. This is a new evidence in the United States that people are becoming aware of this. Because quite frankly, 5 years ago, nobody would have invited me to come and speak about this issue. So I thank you for hosting me here tonight, and I hope it is a sign. But as I said in the closing of my speech, you have an open invitation, whether it's individually or part of your organizations or businesses, to join the rest of us in this growing international cooperation and dialogue on the Arctic and the Himalayas, on the interrelationship between the two and the effect they have on cities and communities in the United States, in Asia, and elsewhere.
Well, we have to end it there. I think all of us will look a little bit differently at ice from tonight forward. We have to end our comments here with President of Iceland, His Excellency Ólafur Ragnar Grímsson. I'm Greg Dalton, and on behalf of the Commonwealth Club and the World Affairs Council, I'd like to thank you all for your excellent questions and for coming this evening. Thank you, Mr. President.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah, thank you.